This effectively means that he will stay in power for much longer than the usual 10 years.
Xi Jinping is elevated to an elite Chinese leader. It's Wednesday, October 25th. This is VOA Asia. Hello and welcome. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Join us on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also ahead, Japan continues under Abenomics. China rapidly developing a Pakistani port. VOA's business scene. The future of warfare robots. Polio down, but not out. It's all on today's VOA Asia. Chinese President Xi Jinping was elevated to an elite status Tuesday at the close of the twice-a-decade Community Party Congress when it inserted his name and political thought into the party constitution, placing alongside other notable Chinese leaders, including founder Mao Zedong and reformer Deng Xiaoping. His concept is described as setting China on the path to becoming a great modern socialist country by mid-century. Addressing what he called a successful Congress, Mr. Xi said the Chinese nation and people embrace brilliant prospects and a bright future. He called for courage and a resolve to build on past achievements and stride forward to an ever-promising future. Willie Lam, an adjunct professor at the Center for China Studies at the Chinese University of Hong Kong, tells VOA's Victor Beatty the party's decision elevates Xi Jinping to become the Mao Zedong of the 21st century.
This effectively means that he will stay in power for much longer than the usual 10 years. That is intense discussion amongst party members that Xi Jinping might remain the country's number one leader until the 21st Party Congress in 2027, or even perhaps if his health allows, until the 22nd Party Congress in 2032, when he will be 79 years old.
Was this a surprise?
Well, this is no surprise, because from day one, 5 years ago when he first seized power, Xi Jinping has been methodically laying the groundwork to build up a kind of a Xi Jinping dynasty. In the past 5 years, he has been very successful in grooming a so-called Xi Jinping faction, which has now emerged as the largest faction within the Communist Party. And this faction, consisting of his cronies, proteges, and loyalists, will definitely support his ambition to remain number one in the party and government for at least 15 years, if not 20 years.
What will this mean for Chinese policy?
In terms of political institutions and traditions, this will be a major retrogression, because when Deng Xiaoping, the chief architect of reform, emerged from power after the Cultural Revolution, Deng Xiaoping was adamant in repudiating one-person rule. Deng Xiaoping has forbidden the personality cult to be erected around leaders, and Deng Xiaoping has laid down major institutional changes, such as retirement age and term limits for party and state leaders. So the fact that Xi Jinping is now effectively the emperor for life means that dictatorial traditions, which were the case during the Cultural Revolution, might be reinstated on a large scale.
This comes just about a week and a half or so before President Trump meets President Xi. Do you expect any difference in the way that the two leaders will treat each other?
Now that Xi Jinping has put his house in order, he will devote more resources and energy to boosting China's global position. On the world stage, China will close the gap with the U.S. China will become a full-fledged superpower, able to challenge the U.S., particularly in the Asia-Pacific arena. All in all, we will expect China to aspire to become the rule setter on the global stage in areas ranging from financial arrangements to globalization to world trade.
Willie Lam said the center of power, the Politburo Standing Committee, will be selected today. He expects the seven-person body to be stacked with Xi loyalists and, likely, no one born later than the 1950s. Another sign Mr. Xi intends to remain on top for some time with no heir apparent. These are among some of the top Asia stories trending on voanews.com. Ghosts of Vietnam stirring as Trump prepares for Asia trip. United States not yet classifying violence against Myanmar Rohingya as ethnic cleansing. Afghan opium production reaches record high. Kim Jong-nam murder suspects visit crime scene. Pyeongchang 2018 flame lit at birthplace of ancient Olympics. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also stop by our voanews.com website. VOA Asia continues. Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe's victory in this past weekend's snap election presumably leads to a continuation of the policies he has pursued since he took office in December 2012, a hard line on North Korea, close ties with Washington, including defense, as well as a super loose monetary policy and a push for nuclear energy. VOA Asia's Ira Melman spoke about this and voters' perception of Abe with Sheila Smith, Senior Fellow for Japan Studies at the Washington-based Council on Foreign Relations.
I don't mind calling Abe a nationalist, largely because he would be happy with that label himself. I think he feels the need for a strong Japan, both in economic terms as well as increasingly in its ability to defend itself. So I think that, you know, the nationalist label isn't necessarily inaccurate. But what I worry sometimes is that people take it to mean certain things that it doesn't. So, for example, Abe has implemented a wide array of security reforms during his time as prime minister since he came back in 2012. So people basically believe that Japan is on its way to militarization or to becoming what it was in the 1930s. And I think that's just not the reality. What it's doing, what he has been arguing, is Japan needs a more ready military. It needs to be able to cope with the growing pressure from North Korea, as well as the pressures, especially maritime pressures, from an expanding China.
You bring up militarization, and that, of course, makes its way to Article 9 of the Japanese Constitution. It came into being right after the Second World War. It renounces war, prohibits an army. A lot of people were saying that was on Abe's hit list, but he seems to have come back a little bit on that.
Well, I think he's argued for revision. It's interesting to note over these last several years, he started to use the word amend more than revision, especially when he's speaking in English. I think what he wants to do, and he said this clearly at the beginning of this year, is he wants to add a sentence to Article 9. He doesn't want to change it. Since 1952, when sovereignty was regained from the United States, they have interpreted the Constitution, Article 9 specifically, to mean that they can defend themselves. But not that they can have a military that will, you know, go abroad and create the kind of horror and destruction that it had in the 1930s. So even its name, the Self-Defense Force, reflects this desire to restrain military force only to the purpose of national defense. And so he just wants to put to bed the constitutional question about whether or not that's legitimate under the current constitution.
What does China think about all of this? If you've been to China, I'm sure you have.
Sure.
You talk to people, and they don't like the Japanese at all, stemming from World War II.
So, of course, and the memory of many people across Asia, not just in China, but in South Korea, in Singapore, in many of the countries where the Japanese military expanded brutally, and also were accused of atrocities during that conflict. The memory of that is very severe and has not been forgotten by contemporary generations. That being said, I think China in particular will be very sensitive to whatever the Japanese want to do, not only in the military realm, but in other realms as well. China itself, as we just saw Xi Jinping say in the National People's Congress, that China itself is on the rise and wants a central place. It wants to be ascendant in global politics and regional politics. And so there will be some irritation here that's not just about war memory in the past, but it's really about the aspirations for who's going to be in the leadership of Asia in the future.
Sheila Smith, Senior Fellow for Japan Studies at the Washington-based Council on Foreign Relations, speaking with VOA Asia's Ira Melman. Happening now in Asia, Myanmar and Bangladesh have agreed to cooperate on the repatriation of Rohingya refugees and took steps to boost border security since relations between the neighbors were strained by the continuing flow of refugees into Bangladesh. More than 600,000 Rohingya Muslims have fled Myanmar since August 25th. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're very happy, as always, to have you with us today on VOA Asia. An unprecedented Chinese financial and construction effort is rapidly developing Pakistan's strategically located Arabian Sea port of Gwadar into one of the world's largest transit and transshipment cargo facilities. VOA's Ayaz Gul reports both sides are hoping to turn the port city into the gateway of a multi-billion dollar bilateral economic corridor being built to connect the two allied nations.
The deep-water Gwadar port lies at the convergence of three of the most commercially important regions of the world, the oil-rich Middle East, Central Asia, and South Asia. Beijing is developing Gwadar as part of the China-Pakistan Economic Corridor, known as CPEC. The two countries launched the 15-year project in 2015 to jointly build highways, railways, power plants, communications, and industrial zones in Pakistan, with a Chinese investment initially estimated at $46 billion. The aim is to link Gwadar to landlocked western China to give it a shorter and secure route through Pakistan to global markets. Some in Pakistan are worried skilled Chinese laborers, engineers, and businesses will flood the country, hurting domestic industries.
I think it is not true.
Dostain Khan Jamaldini, the top Pakistani administrator at the port, says about 65% of the labor force on construction and other projects at Gwadar is Pakistani, and the number of Chinese is currently just over 300.
Look now, this is the building you can see, which is under construction, all prefabricated with the Chinese technology. For erecting such a massive building in 2 or 3 months, I don't think so that we can do it right now. But yes, with this work, gradually the transfer of technology is also coming to Pakistan. And it will further minimize the presence of Chinese experts and engineers from Pakistan.
Chinese fuel imports and trading cargo will be loaded on trucks and ferried to and from the western Xinjiang region through the Karakoram Highway, snaking past snow-capped peaks in northern Pakistan. Officials anticipate Gwadar will become South Asia's biggest shipping center within 5 years, with a yearly capacity of handling 13 million tons of cargo. And by 2030, they say the port will be handling up to 400 million tons of cargo annually. Security concerns and India's claims over some of the territory crossed by the massive project remain key challenges for Gwadar and CPEC in general. Just beyond Gwadar's two semicircular bays, the Arabian Sea meets the Persian Gulf, and local fishermen ply the crystal blue waters as they have for generations. The coastal city's poverty-stricken residents are mostly fishermen and boat makers. They are hoping new employment opportunities will be created for them in the wake of the massive development underway in Gwadar. But residents say hours-long daily power outages and a scarcity of water are the immediate problems facing them.
We are facing frequent power blackouts and water shortages.
We got no fish today and came back empty handed.
Ayaz Gul for VOA News, Gwadar, Pakistan.
You're listening to VOA Asia.
From Pink to Pitbull, Beyonce to Bruno Mars, the hits live here on the Top 20 Countdown. Hi, I'm Ray McDonald, and for the past 30 years, I've been counting down the very best of the Billboard Hot 100 Pop Singles Chart. The hit list never sleeps, so don't you miss a moment of the action. Join me every Thursday for the Top 20 Countdown, right here and worldwide on the Voice of America.
This news alert from VOA Asia. Two women on trial for murdering the half-brother of North Korean leader Kim Jong-un were taken to Kuala Lumpur International Airport, where they allegedly poisoned him. Wearing bulletproof vests and escorted by heavily armed guards, they toured the crime scene with the judge, defense lawyers, and prosecutors. Visit VOA Asia Facebook each day for top stories. This is VOA Asia. VOA Asia continues. This week's VOA's Business Scene with Skylar Ogden focuses on China's evolving automobile market, along with wins and losses for Abenomics in Japan.
This is Business Scene. I'm Skylar Ogden. China is making a significant shift towards the electric car business. Geely Holding Company, which owns Volvo, plans to invest $760 million in their electric vehicle brand called Polestar. The first Polestar car will be a two-door plug-in hybrid with 600 horsepower. Hakan Samuelson is the chief executive officer of Volvo.
I think China is also very positive that the Chinese government is also have a very firm strategy going electric, and I think they are promoting electrification. I think that is very positive.
The Chinese government has set quotas for electric and hybrid vehicles and has begun looking at an eventual ban on the sale of cars using fossil fuels. Thomas Ingenlath is the CEO of Polestar.
Definitely there is the big wave of having to have an electric offer in the Chinese market. Again, I think driven by two things. Yes, there is partly the pressure being put on that there's a certain percentage of electric cars that you have to have. On the other hand as well, because it is an attractive offer.
Polestar 1 will go into production in the western Chinese city of Chengdu in mid-2019 and will be followed by a smaller, fully electric Polestar 2. Prime Minister Shinzo Abe's third election victory has many shopkeepers in Tokyo shrugging their shoulders. They say the Prime Minister's economic policies, known as Abenomics, simply haven't trickled down to the street level. Shopkeeper Michiko Hachiman.
On a good day, when I was just married, we had lots of customers here in the evening because there were many meat and deli shops. I miss those days, but they will not come back.
On the face of it, Abenomics, a combination of ultra-loose monetary policy and big fiscal spending, has resulted in strong growth and solid business confidence. The stock market is at a 21-year high and unemployment is low. But other economic indicators tell a different story. Debt is almost twice the size of Japan's economic output, wages have stagnated, and deflation continues. 67-year-old shopkeeper Kozo Ito says that visitors here think there is a bank holiday because so many shops are closed.
I tell them, no, they have just shut down.
While Shinzo Abe's victory is seen by some as a vote of confidence for Abenomics, a look at the deserted streets and shuttered stores in Tokyo's commercial district tell a different story. For VOA's Business Scene, I'm Skylar Ogden.
This news alert from VOA Asia, British writer Richard Thorns is launching a seventh expedition into the inaccessible wilds of Myanmar to search for the pink-headed duck that has not been seen alive since 1949 and that was in India. No one has seen the bird alive in Myanmar in more than a century. All the big stories come your way throughout the day on VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, with air drones now being a fixture in the nearly every army's arsenal, defense industries are hard at work developing ground and underwater robotic vehicles, trying not to fall behind others. Most of the technology has already been developed for industrial robots and the rapidly expanding self-driving vehicle segment of the automotive industry. VOA's George Pudich looks at the state of warfare robots.
While prominent intellectuals and human rights organizations keep calling for a comprehensive ban on so-called killer robots, some say it is already too late. Weaponized aerial drones are now a standard in every army's arsenal, so the focus shifts to ground and underwater environments.
Today, everybody is flying different kind, different model, different size of unmanned air vehicles, and the trend on the land domain is becoming very, very serious. Just like you see, I know, a level of a semi-autonomous coming in the industry and commercial car business. The military is no different.
This small all-terrain robotic vehicle built by German manufacturer Rheinmetall can easily be adapted to carry lethal weapons. The manufacturer claims the robot will be able to distinguish friends from foes and that it will obey commands of its human operators. But rights organizations such as Human Rights Watch have long expressed concern about the danger of autonomous robotic weapons.
One of the things that holds us back from barbarism in contexts of war is obviously this distinction between combatants and civilians. And we're worried about, you know, a robotic weapon of the future not being able to distinguish between a child holding out an ice cream and someone holding a weapon.
In today's increasingly polarized world, countries are nervous about the possibility of a potential adversary being able to develop a technology that will give them an advantage in a conflict. Experts say advances in robotics and nanotechnology may shift future conflict underwater, so considerable research is being done in that direction.
The world looks increasingly to the maritime environment for natural resources, and also the ability to operate in the maritime environment is simplified by offboard and autonomous vessels for a whole host of operators. So the requirement for the Royal Navy to be at the forefront of technological thinking to provide the security and protection is only going to increase.
Earlier this year, 126 founders and directors of more than 100 robotic and artificial intelligence companies from 28 countries signed an open letter urging governments to take action for a comprehensive ban on autonomous weapons. But no action has been taken. George Putich, VOA News, Washington.
Nearly 30 years ago, 1,000 children a day were paralyzed by the polio virus. So far this year, just 11 children have been diagnosed with polio, thanks to a global effort to wipe out the polio virus. The effort has produced amazing results. But as VOA's Carol Pearson reports, those behind it say it's not time yet to celebrate.
There are only two places in the entire world where children have caught polio this year. Afghanistan and Pakistan. The worldwide effort to end this disease is massive, according to Carol Pandek of Rotary International.
Hundreds of thousands of frontline healthcare workers who are out there, you know, every day immunizing children in urban areas, in remote areas, in all sorts of settings.
Rotary International was the first organization to promote the global effort to end polio. At one time, in some countries, health workers risked their lives to immunize the children. Pandek says that is no longer the case.
What we found to be very successful is to use people from the communities, or not use them, but, you know, employ them to be the ones that are approaching families for vaccination, because these people are trusted within the community, they're known to the community, and that seems to have really helped to alleviate some of those issues around safety for vaccinators.
The challenge now is to get to zero cases and to maintain that level for at least 3 years.
We need to maintain a strong surveillance to make sure we detect every single case, and then the community react to every single case that appear. So the strength of that surveillance is a critical element for reaching the final end for polio.
Getting to the end is actually the hardest part of the campaign. Governments and organizations have to keep up their commitment. Otherwise, the virus can continue to spread.
We must remain vigilant and focused till we're absolutely certain that the last case has been found and that we have got everybody protected.
That's why the theme of this year's World Polio Day is We're Not Done Yet. Carol Pearson, VOA News, Washington.
You've been listening to VOA Asia. We're heard on great radio stations throughout Asia, like the Voice of Chungrung, Star Radio FM 88.3 at Chungrung Christian University in Tainan, Taiwan. Thanks to everyone there who's listening, and wherever you may be today, we're glad you've been with us. We'd also invite you to write to us. You can contact us through Facebook at VOA Asia. You can also email us at voaasia@voanews.com. If on one of those rare days you can't get our program, you can download us from iTunes and SoundCloud and take VOA Asia wherever you go. We thank our director, Tracy Carter, engineer, Daryl Smith, managing editor, Diane Gao, Skylar Ogden, Ira Melman, and David Bird on our VOA Asia team. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're all in Washington. We hope you have a wonderful day ahead.